This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. In 1888, Vincent van Gogh, or Van Gogh, depending on how you like to pronounce it, in either case, he dashed off a letter to his brother Theo. He described a painting he was working on. His tiny bedroom in France was the subject. Looking at the painting should rest the mind, or rather the imagination, he told Theo. Arguably, that painting might be the most famous bedroom in art. With its sky blue walls, its yellow chairs, and red blanket, Van Gogh's bedroom is beloved by art fans. In fact, Van Gogh himself loved the first bedroom painting so much, he painted it 2 more times. Since his death, Van Gogh's 3 bedrooms have been scattered in museums across the globe, but last month they were reunited in a show at Chicago's Art Institute. It's a big moment for Van Gogh fans and for science, because by bringing Van Gogh's bedrooms together, museum scientists made a startling discovery. Those blue walls are not so blue after all. My next guest helped solve this art history mystery. Francesca Casadillo is the Andrew W. Mellon Senior Conservation Scientist at the Art Institute in Chicago. Welcome back to Science Friday.
Thank you, Ira. It's a pleasure to be here.
And we're going to be tweeting out paintings as we're talking. So if you want to follow along and see some pictures, I can't see them on the radio, but we're going to tweet them at SciFry and you can get an idea. How can a painting change after it's gone up on the wall like that?
Well, we hardly put art and science together, but there's actually a lot of chemistry happening as soon as the paint leaves the brush. And so there's constant change, like there is change and shifting in our own bodies as we age. And some pigments in particular we are finding are changing colors more quickly than others, especially due to the effect of light and humidity. And this is because when you enter into a museum, we keep temperature and humidity and light very controlled because we know those are factors that can accelerate that shifting.
All right, let's get a sense of what the bedroom looks like a little bit more. We're tweeting this painting out right now, and it's on our website so people can follow along. Unless you're driving, we don't want you to do that. If you were to visit Van Gogh's bedroom painting today, what would you see, Francesca?
Well, first of all, people visiting Chicago can actually try to snatch one stay on Airbnb because we have recreated this painting in an apartment in the Chicago neighborhood. But in any case, what I would see is a very small room, but with very, as you described in Van Gogh's own words, very brightly painted furniture, the yellow chairs and the bedstand and the floors of pink and green hues, and the window frame is a bright green, as was very typical both in France and in my home country, Italy. And there are paintings on the wall because, of course, Van Gogh also feverishly decorated this room for himself and for the community of artists that he was hoping to attract to the south of France. There's a lot of excitement in his description of the bedroom, and this sentiment is transpiring also in the depiction of the bedroom itself.
So what was your first clue that these bedroom walls weren't always so blue?
Well, the first clue was actually given to us not only by our curator, Gloria Groom, who curated the exhibition, but by Van Gogh himself, because you read the description, as you have, Ira, and it says the bedspread is red, the window green, the walls are lilac, the doors are purple, and you're like, wait a minute. The walls and doors are no longer lilac and purple, and the floor doesn't look that broken, faded red tiles that he's describing. And because science and technology have evolved so much these days, and in the past 10 years, we've become more attuned to the fact that these pigments can change, and we now can measure that change, and we can identify those fading pigments, we immediately set out to try to answer these questions. Were the walls of the Chicago painting painted in a different color and it's no longer purple, or is there something going on here? So it was a wonderful detective type work that we were allowed to do on this iconic masterpiece.
Let's talk about some of that detective work. I know that one of these tools you used looks sort of like a blaster gun from Star Trek.
Absolutely. Well, we use a gun-like instrument that emits X-rays, and it's a way of getting information about the pigments without having to touch the surface or remove even the smallest amount of material. And actually, this technology was developed to go on the Mars rover originally to do exploration in space. And we can use it for art because it basically allows us to identify the atoms that make these pigments if they are derived from mineral, from what we call inorganic sources. And so this gave us a little bit of a time machine to go back and understand what colors Van Gogh put on his palette, but yet didn't answer completely the question about what made the purple. And this is because, in general, these purples and pinks were made from natural sources like insects and plants, or from the booming chemical industries of the 19th century that produced so many new pigments, and the impressionists and those artists of the times embraced them. And so that required some extra effort beyond using X-ray fluorescence, this kind of elemental fingerprinting using X-rays.
Yeah. You did take a tiny paint chip from the painting, right? And that was sort of the smoking gun?
Absolutely. It was... we use scalpels, like surgical scalpels, and under a microscope with a very steady hand, you don't want to have had too much caffeine that day, we remove a sample that is no bigger than a dot on a printed page. And my colleague Inga Fiedler, who's been a research microscopist with the museum for the longest time, called us up. She mounted this fragment on a microscope slide, and then we were all huddling around the microscope because when you looked at the surface of the sample, it was light blue, but when she flipped it over, exposing the bottom part of this paint layer, which had not been exposed to light, it was purple, and you could see all these pink particles that had been preserved because they had not been directly exposed to light.
We asked our audience on Twitter which version of the painting they liked better. We got 2,600 votes, and 55% of the people liked the recolored purple version. Does that surprise you?
That's good news. Well, I think that we're excited that we are able, through science and the letters and conservation and art history, to propose this new visualization of what the painting looked like. And this, people should realize, is really an expression of Van Gogh's emotional state, because we know from art historical research that our colleagues have done that the walls of the bedroom were whitewashed. So he very deliberately picks these colors also because he was interested in the effects of putting together a purple with a yellow, these complementary colors that make then enhance the strength of the image. I can quote him saying, "I want to make simplicity with bright colors." And so it's exciting that today, with chemistry and science and conservation, we can propose this visualization. But we also all have to understand that this, we're part of a continuum of the history of this painting. And so we don't want to say one version is better than the other. Yeah. It's just getting closer to the ET moment of connection, of human connection with something that resonates with so many of us. So it's great that you got so many responses.
Well, I should have mentioned that we made a digital version of the Van Gogh. You made it of a Van Gogh's bedroom painting, and showing what it might have looked like when he painted it. And we put that up on our website, and it's still there at sciencefriday.com/Van Gogh, and that's where people can actually see the difference. And we also tweeted out the paint chip, and you can see it as it flashes back and forth. It looks blue on one side, and it looks purple on the other side. Why did the purple fade? Was it, did Van Gogh sort of, did he know that the paints, were they cheap paints because he couldn't afford better, or is that just the state of the art of the day?
Well, this is a myth that we're very happy as museum scientists to be able to dispel, because some of these pink colors, we can go back to 19th century catalogs of color makers, and they were as expensive as other colors. But certainly at the time when Van Gogh painted, he was aware that some of these colors would lose their strength. And in fact, he says paintings fade like flowers. But still, he thought that if he painted them boldly, they would maybe be toned down. And this was a sentiment shared by many of his peers. Renoir, also we have quotes from him. I don't think that they were aware that, especially when mixed with other pigments and if exposed to regular unfiltered light, this pink and purples could completely vanish.
Hmm. And this is really an interesting thing, because this is going to be on exhibit, and you're in Chicago, and you can see the paintings, the Van Gogh's bedroom paintings in the flesh. They're on view at the Art Institute in Chicago through May 10th. This must be, I wish I was in Chicago to see this. Or you see these three paintings all together in one place.
It's really the opportunity of a lifetime, Ira. I don't think that for the next two centuries this will be possible. And what is exciting, really, of this presentation that Gloria Groom has done that we want to share with the public who comes to Chicago and will come to Chicago, is to be able to see the three-bedroom paintings all together. And then you turn your head slightly and you can see an immersive digital experience that will give you a sense of the physicality of Van Gogh's brushstrokes. And then we have a very comprehensive video that explains this behind the scene exploration. So it's really very, very exciting.
Very. I wish I were there. Thank you for taking time to talk to us about it, Francesca. Have a good
Thanks
weekend.
To you,
Ira. And good luck with that exhibit. Francesca Casadillo is a senior conservation scientist at the Art Institute in Chicago, and you can see the bedroom paintings, what they might have looked like in 1889, at sciencefriday.com/Van Gogh if you can't make it to the museum. We're going to take a break and come back with gooey physics of melted cheese. If you like cheese, this is for you. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Our next subject is something of a biological enigma. Listen about this. It's not living, but it's not quite dead either. It's often infested with bacteria, or sometimes crawling with tiny mites. It can be covered in bandages or coated in ash, and you can smell it from across the room. No, I'm not talking about a zombie. I'm talking about cheese. Yeah, one of the most captivating and delicious and sometimes unusual foods out there. It's one of my favorite foods, and it's the subject of a special Sci-Fry investigation this week and next on the radio and on the web at sciencefriday.com/cheese. And here to tell us all about it are Chow Tu. She's Science Friday's story producer and reporter, and Luke Raskin, our video producer. Welcome to both of you.
Hi, Ira.
Chow, I know this project was your idea,
yes,
right?
Yes, it was.
Why cheese? I mean, and why not? I mean, I love cheese.
I love cheese, too. So that's pretty much where it started. But I also thought about the different varieties of cheese. There's brie, there's cheddar, there's vegan cheese. So I was thinking about the techniques that cheesemakers were, you know, using, the ingredients, the bacterial cultures, you know, the aging processes. So it's kind of rich for a scientific investigation.
Kind of rich. I like that play of words. You profiled a cheesemaker from Wisconsin who makes a special kind of cheddar.
Yes. So Willie Lehner of Bluemont Dairy in Wisconsin, he makes this bandage cheddar, which is a cheddar that's bound in cheesecloth. And it's a very, very popular cheddar amongst, you know, cheese fans.
It went very fast in our office when you brought it.
It's really, really good.
Yeah.
So the thing about this cheddar is that it has a really important aging process. Because it's just bound in cheesecloth, it needs to be kind of protected as it's being aged. So what Willie does is he dunks it in hot lard right after he brings it in into his cheese cave. And that lard helps keep the cheese moist, and it also protects it from different, like, you know, cracks or cheese mites. But there's also a mold that grows on top of the lard, and so the cheese mites actually eat that mold as the cheese is aging. And these cheese mites are really, really tiny. They're like smaller than the size of a period at the end of a sentence. And they also can reproduce every 9 days. So this can be a problem. But
I'm not eating the mites when I eat the cheese.
You're not. No, don't worry.
How does he get rid of the mites?
He uses a vacuum. So all these cheeses are vacuumed over the course of a couple of weeks and over the course of a couple of months as the cheese is aged. Nice. And yeah, eventually it becomes a really, really tasty and earthy cheddar.
I love it. And Luke, you stayed local for a look at the making of mozzarella.
Describe it
here in New York.
So I went up to a street called Arthur Avenue. It's about 3 blocks from the Bronx Zoo.
Very famous place.
Very famous. It's a street that's lined with Italian delis, bakeries, and butchers. Just really, really, you know, classic Italian ingredients, really delicious food. And I went to one such deli where there was to meet a master of mozzarella, a true master of mozzarella.
My name is Orazio Carciotto. I've been making mozzarella about 30 years. My business is called Casa della Mozzarella. M-O-Z-Z-A-R-E-L-L-A. Mozzarella. Best way to eat the mozzarella, same day. So if you put something fresh in the refrigerator, you lose a lot because like the mozzarella gets dry. No refrigerator mozzarella.
No refrigerator mozzarella. You hear?
Wow. Yeah.
If you get
something new to me, because you get it in the refrigerator all the time in the food store.
Exactly. If you're getting it fresh, don't put it in the refrigerator. Leave it out. If you're going to eat it the next day, you do have to put it in the refrigerator. But you shouldn't do that. You should eat it the same day. He's got all sorts of tips like that to help you get the most out of your mozzarella.
Does he have a master recipe that he uses to do this?
Actually, incidentally, he doesn't. So it's a very simple thing to make. It's just cheese curd, salt, and boiling hot water. And you would think there would be a very simple master recipe for that, but with him, there isn't. He's been doing this for 30 years. His hand is his thermometer when he's checking the temperature. He knows exactly how much salt to add. And so, you know, even though he has this kind of mastered, there are very specific variables that over the 30 years he's experimented with. Mm-hmm. And he's figured out. And if you watch the video, you'll see what the trick of it is.
It is a gorgeous video. And Chow, our celebration of cheese science is going to continue all next week, right?
Yes. So you can make your own mozzarella at home. There's an educational activity that we have on our site. We also have an article about vegan cheeses where we talk about using tree nuts like cashews to make plant-based cheeses.
If you don't want to use milk in it.
Exactly.
Right?
Exactly. Next week on the show, you'll be talking to a microbiologist about the bacteria battle happening inside of cheese and how that affects taste and flavor. And then there'll be a dairy scientist from South Dakota talking about the history of processed cheese. So all of this is on our website. It's at sciencefriday.com/cheese.
It's all up there now.
Yes.
And your video?
At sciencefriday.com/cheese.
And we watch him make his, he doesn't say mozzarella. I thought that was interesting.
Mozzarella.
Because so many New Yorkers say mozzarella.
Yeah, mozzarella.
And he shows us how he makes that.
Oh, yeah. He's got. I mean, one really amazing way that he does it. He's been doing this 30 years. He actually touches the boiling hot cheese in order to stretch it quicker so that the butterfat milk doesn't leave the cheese. The quicker you do it, the less butterfat milk comes out, the more rich your cheese comes out. So he's just touching the cheese with his bare hands.
He's sticking his hand into boiling water.
Yeah, yes. And his cheese tastes so good.
And his hands show the effects,
yes,
right?
Yes, that's right.
And this is great. It's up there on our website at sciencefriday.com. And I want to thank you both for alerting us to Cheese Week coming up next week.
Our pleasure.
Okay. Thank you, Chow Tu and Luke Raskin, our video producer. Chow Tu is our story producer and reporter. Thanks, guys. Next up, speaking of melted mozzarella, ever wondered why it gets so stringy when you heat it up? Well, it turns out that melty liquid cheese like fondue and queso, they are the ideal subjects for a luscious lesson in fluid dynamics. Yeah, so grab your cheese dip and get a little of this on your chip. David Hu is a mechanical engineer and associate professor in the Department of Mechanical Engineering and Biology at Georgia Tech in Atlanta. He joins us from the studios of Georgia Public Broadcasting today. Welcome back, Dr. Hu.
It's great to be here, Ira.
The fluid mechanics of cheese. Who would ever thought that that's possible?
Cheese is a special kind of fluid. We call it a non-Newtonian fluid, and actually, most of the fluids around us are all non-Newtonian, especially ones made by nature.
What does that mean? What does that mean? When, you know, especially queso, non-Newtonian fluid. What does that mean to us?
A non-Newtonian fluid is a fluid that has kind of a properties of both a liquid and a solid. So it kind of mixes these both together. So an example of a solid are things that are springy. For example, like you sit in a chair and it yields slightly. Fluids, you can fill up a container and they'll sort of fill all the spaces. And now cheese is kind of this mix between these two worlds because it's composed of mostly liquid, but then a lot of really small springs. And these springs allow the fluid to have a lot of, well, let's call it personality. The cheese can remember what was done to it in the processing, and that affects its properties later.
And so let me see if I got that right. It remembers what was done to it in the processing.
Yeah, that's right. If you, for example, when you make this string cheese, you stretch these fluid molecules. You'll stretch the little springs, and then this will make the springs aligned. And so when you pull it apart, you'll sort of get these long strings. But if you melt it, it sort of erases the brain of the non-Newtonian fluid. It just starts it all over again, and it puts all these molecules just sort of running around doing whatever they want. That's why when you sort of melt it, you can just pour cheese just like a liquid. But then when you solidify it, it remembers sort of the manner at which it was solidified.
That's fascinating. Why do you think that non-Newtonian fluids are so pleasing to us when we eat them?
So once you start mixing fluids with solids, you bring in this concept of elasticity. So it's the degree of softness. And the amazing thing about our mouth, so our tongue is very, very sensitive. We can really tell the difference between different levels of softness. And now softness is it's an interesting variable because it has a range of over a million fold. Like if you think of the softest pillow all the way up to a piece of steel, it's a range of a million different levels of softness. And we can basically taste these things. You imagine eating crackers and then eating cheese. It's mixing these two together. So we really get a lot of texture, and it gives it a new dimension.
That is interesting. You know, I never thought about why cheese and crackers go together so well, but you're saying it's because they're so totally opposite.
Yeah, it brings them the solid, elastic nature of the cheese kind of puts it in the same realm as the crackers. We can sort of start to compare them. I don't think, for example, crackers and liquid, they're sort of two different worlds.
Yeah. I know the cheese industry and food industry must spend a lot of money trying to find that right kind of cheese that your mouth loves.
There's a whole industry of synthetic fluid-like materials, things like chocolate, things like cheese, and not even just things that we eat, but the entire supermarket's filled with materials that have been specially tuned to exhibit both solid-like and fluid-like properties. For example, so when I used to go to Taiwan when I was young, when I went, they actually didn't have shampoo like we had it. People used to use powder as shampoo. And so you imagine you want to put soap in your hair, you put a pile of powder on your hand, and it basically just spills everywhere. Now they invent shampoo, basically a kind of liquid that can basically act like a solid when it's in your hand, but as soon as you start smushing it in your hair, it becomes liquid again.
You know, I never thought about that. That's absolutely. You always wonder why. Yeah, you wonder how does it get.
And that's someone had to invent that. Otherwise, imagine you put a liquid, something just totally liquid-like, and it just goes through your fingers. Like, how do you give someone a handful of shampoo? You can't because it won't fit in your hand. So someone had to add these little polymers, just like they have done with the cheese, to make it basically act like a dollop, but not like a hard dollop, like peanut butter, but like a dollop that you can actually spread around.
Well, you know, I know that you actually had a run-in at the airport once where you used fluid dynamics to get you out of a tight situation. Tell us about that.
Oh, right. These airlines, right, they don't have food on the airline. So I would just bring whatever I had in my fridge. And there was one day I brought this split pea soup, which is it's interesting because when it's warmed up, it's a liquid. But when it's cold, it acts like a solid. And so they said they looked at this split pea soup. They're like, that's not liquid. You can't bring that. I said, no, but it's non-Newtonian. And so I flipped it upside down, and it didn't fall out of the container. And they said, non-new what? But anyway, they let me go through because I could convince them that under certain conditions, this kind of non-Newtonian fluid can trick people into believing it's a solid.
This is quite educational. I'm talking with David Hu, mechanical engineer in the Department of Engineering and Biology at Georgia Tech in Atlanta, on Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. We're talking about everything you wanted to know about the fluid dynamics of cheese. Now, let's talk about queso. I know, it's because we're now into that world. How do you test the properties of queso in your lab? It's got to be more complicated than just putting some in a bowl and dipping a chip in it, right?
So that's actually almost how they do it. So they actually have
it's very cheap equipment.
Well, these devices called rheometers. They are basically like $50,000 blenders, and you just put a very small dollop of this fluid in, and they're so expensive because they sit on air bearings, so they basically are totally frictionless. And they can sort of have these, imagine it looks like two Oreo cookies, and they rub the cookies back and forth like you're taking a chip and sort of twisting it back and forth. And they measure basically how the queso responds to you twisting the chip. In certain cases, if the queso starts cooling down, it'll start acting very springy. So you'll twist the chip, and it'll twist your hand right back. Mm-hmm. But if you heat up the queso, it'll act more like a fluid, and it'll just smoothly turn as you twist the chip.
Mm-hmm. We're talking about cheese. Now, if you want to get in on this, there's a lot of fun stuff going on. 844-724-8255 is our number if you'd like to call. Let's see if we can get a call in before we go to the break. Mike in Inverness, Florida. Hi, welcome to Science Friday.
Hey, how you doing?
Hey there.
Hey, Mike.
I was wondering when you were talking about the string cheese and you said, you know, you pulled it apart and it's like in strips. But if you were to melt it and then it would lose its memory, after you melted it, if you let it solidify again and pulled it apart, would it still come in the string, lines, the strips like that before? Or would it have a new, design to it?
He's got a project for this evening, I can see here. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Once you melt, so the interesting thing about cheese is that basically it's a liquid when it's hot, and then the molecules are just random. They're just all, and in fact, when you're boiling it, the molecules are just literally running around. And as soon as you cool it down, you want to sort of make it in some kind of configuration. And so while it's cooling, right before it becomes solid, you can sort of stretch it, and then sort of people sort of push it into these long sticks. And that'll help align these long stringy molecules so that they're facing the same direction.
Mm-hmm. Knowing what you know about the fluid dynamics of cheese, is there a right way and a wrong way to eat it?
I think the right way is you want to stretch it a lot. You really want
all cheese? You want to stretch it or just? Cheddar or Gouda?
At least pizza cheese. I like stretching it. I mean, when you pull this, pull the
Parmesan.
Pizza, off pizza slice from the rest of it, you'll see these cheese actually stretches. So that's not a typical fluid. That's with these long springy molecules really sort of absorbing the energy as you're pulling this away. And if you look carefully, as you're stretching it, this cheese will sort of spring back like little springs. That really shows that it's the nature of these really long filaments.
Yeah. And it's getting it off of here. Everything that it stretches onto, that is the challenge.
Yeah.
It makes that giant loop.
And nature really takes advantage of these things. I mean, they don't make cheese, but they make sort of the equivalent because, I mean, I would say cheese is sort of everywhere in American cuisine. And in nature, the equivalent of cheese is mucus. I mean, they put this thing in everything.
Okay, good place to take a break. No, come back. I want to follow up on this. In nature, it's mucus. Mucus equal to cheese. There's a takeaway for Science Friday, this show. We're going to come back and talk more with David Hu about cheese. Our number 844-724-8255. We will explore this further when we get back. Stay with us. This is Science Friday. I am Ira Flato. We're talking with David Hu, a mechanical engineer, professor at Georgia Tech in Atlanta. We're talking about the fluid dynamics of cheese. Of course, when you tune into Science Friday, you know that's what we're going to be talking about with an engineer talking about cheese. And the most fascinating part, which I said I would follow up on before the break, is that, David, you said that the closest thing in nature to cheese is saliva. Mucus, not saliva. I can't let you get away with that without explaining that a little bit more.
Well, so, yeah, the interesting thing about, cheese and these other non-Newtonian fluids is that you just add a little bit of this special ingredient and you can totally change its properties. So mucus is one thing that almost everything in nature makes. And so it's similar to cheese. Imagine if you had a big vat of cheese, like something like a swimming pool, and you got stuck in it. How would you get out?
Mm.
Well, this is exactly the problem that is faced by little flies when they fall into these horrible traps called pitcher plants. There are these plants in the rainforest that literally look like pitchers, and they exude some kind of sweet scent, and the flies want to sort of come and check it out. And the pitcher plants fill with rainwater, and they add a little bit of extra ingredient, and what they basically makes the rainwater in the pitcher plant, it makes it essentially like cheese. And so this little fly sort of goes for a dip in the pitcher plant, and flies are actually pretty good at swimming, but the problem is it's really hard to swim through cheese. Because every time this fly is flailing about, every time it lifts one of its little legs, instead of sort of forming drops like we do in a swimming pool, you sort of pull up this big string of cheese. And it does this with one leg, and the problem is it's got six legs, so it'll take all these six legs and wail them around, and sooner or later it's sort of twisted and turned itself into sort of a rope of cheese. It's really twisted itself and tied itself up with the mucus and then sort of trapped there.
You know, the Smothers Brothers used to have a song they did, I fell into a vat of chocolate, and it had us about swimming around and trying to get out. This is sort of the same thing, falling
into... Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's these, and it's the ability of these, for example, cheese and mucus and these other kinds of special fluids, they can generate long, stringy things. And that's not typical. If you were to pour water out of a pitcher, when you stop pouring, it wouldn't sort of have this long string that you'd have to separate. But that's the problem with these. Or in the pitcher plant's case, that's the solution.
Yeah. You know, you sound like, a geeky guy who loves to talk about cheese. And fluid dynamics. How did you get so involved? What captures your imagination about fluids? When did you first learn that you were interested in fluids?
Oh, when I first learned? I think when I started realizing that fluids are everywhere. And we've basically sort of figured out how to sort of, like I said, these non-Newtonian fluids have personalities. We've figured out how to sort of change their personalities to just do what we want. So I'll give you another example. So paint is a nice example of a cheese-like substance of a non-Newtonian fluid. It's for example, paint, we want to basically be able to take a brush and a paint can and sort of mix it around with a brush, and we want to be able to coat the brush with it. But then we want to be able to throw it on the walls, and we want it to not fall off the wall. So that's one of the properties of similar cheese-like property. It basically acts like a fluid when you mix it really fast, but then once you sort of put it on the wall and it's dripping slowly, it solidifies. And it doesn't. We don't have to do anything special. We just sort of change the personality of the fluid so it just sticks to the wall without falling down.
Is ketchup non-Newtonian?
Oh, yeah, ketchup is non-Newtonian. And, that's why it's generated this whole craze of people trying to figure out how to get out of the bottle. It's just like paint that basically if you push it really fast, it'll sort of be fluid-like. But if you push it too slowly, for example, when there's just a little bit left at the end of the bottle, it doesn't weigh enough, then you sort of have to just bang, bang at it. And then once you exceed this sort of critical amount of force, it just flies out. It's sort of just like this, this person that's, you know, just seems like they're calm and steady, and then suddenly when you push them a little too hard, they just sort of go explosive. Mm. That's what ketchup's like.
Mm-hmm. So if you're a school teacher and you want to do a demonstration in your class of non-Newtonian fluids, cheese would be a good thing to use.
Yeah, cheese would be great because it really, you know, you could pour it. It can fill in molds, and then you can stretch it. And you can see it really is basically, you can stretch it, and it can really absorb some energy, but then you can basically melt it down again. You can't do that with too many things that taste good.
Do you have your own favorite cheese, that, above all, to use in your lab or just to eat?
I actually really like blue cheese, you know, the kind that looks like it has mold in it. But then every time, the problem is, so I'm Chinese, every time my mom comes over and she sees the fridge and there's this blue cheese in it, she thinks this is just totally rotten and she'll just throw it away. I say, no, it's supposed to be like that. It's actually kind of expensive.
I can't top that, so I'm going to say goodbye. Say hello to your mom for us next time you see when we talk about cheese. Thank you, David.
Sure.
It was fascinating. David Hu is a mechanical engineer and associate professor in the departments of mechanical engineering and biology, a rambling wreck from Georgia Tech in Atlanta. Thanks for joining us. And for more cheese science, check out our spotlight at sciencefriday.com/cheese. And our gooey, salty saga is going to continue next week. More cheese on the show also. The cost of cable television, you know, cable can be pretty pricey. There is the installation fee, the service charge, the monthly rental fee for the cable box, the gatekeeper to your weekly binge watching. And those monthly cable box fees can add up. You know what I'm talking about. Cable subscribers spend $20 billion each year on those little boxes. Well, the Federal Communication Commission has proposed to crack open the cable box and let companies outside of the big cable suppliers to build a better box. My next guest is here to walk us through what this would mean for customers and big cable. Brian Barrett is a contributing editor for Wired. He's based in Birmingham, Alabama, and he joins us from WBHM Studios. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
So tell us, the FCC put out their proposal last month, and they're now asking for comments. Tell us what the proposal says.
So, in terms of specifics, we still don't have a ton of those, but we know that what the FCC wants to do basically is open up competition in the cable box space. Right now, 98% or so of U.S. cable customers get their boxes directly from the cable company that they're subscribed to, and many of those people don't even know that they could have an option if they wanted one. It's a sort of a monopolistic system in a system that's already kind of monopolistic. So what the FCC is saying is, look, we want to set some guidelines to make it easier for outside manufacturers, third parties, to create cable boxes. And we want to open up that market so that they can basically, take the content from the cable companies and present it in a way that might be better, might be different, but basically, above all, gives options to customers.
So what's exactly inside the box? What is the box doing?
The box is doing a few things. You sort of take it for granted that while it's sitting there, but there's a lot going on under the hood. The biggest thing that it does is it takes the signal from your cable company and basically translates it so that it can show up on your television. Beyond that, though, there's also a lot of other technology in there, a lot of software that the companies have invested in. Every time you open up the TV guide, every time you go to an on-demand station, that software that is proprietary to the company, your cable company. And beyond that, it also has a hard drive to support your DVR most of the time. So just like your computer has a hard drive that stores all your files on it, a cable box needs to keep room for all of that video that you've recorded that you want to catch up on later.
Unless they're doing it now at the cable company and some of those boxes. But it's also, I would imagine, mostly to de-scramble the signal because they don't want you to steal the signal. You need the cable box.
Exactly, that's right. And that's, you know, that's something that the FCC has been careful to say is that, you know, solutions that come out or that will be, you know, present outside of the current arrangement would still have all of those security systems in place. It wouldn't impact any of the advertising deals or the programming deals that cable companies have established. It's basically just making sure that there is hardware that people can shop around for if they want to. So the question is, how exactly do you plan to do that? That's what we still have to see.
Well, if they're making, you know, if it's a $20 billion a year business and I don't have to buy that box anymore from the cable company, they're going to be fighting this like crazy, I would think.
They are, and they already have been. They've been very aggressively going after the FCC in this. And their arguments, such as they are, makes some sense. It's not just a strictly financial concern. From their point of view, they're saying two things. First, basically, we shouldn't even be regulating cable boxes in the first place. Cable boxes are an outdated technology. We should be more focused on what comes after the cable box. And secondly, they're concerned that some programmers are concerned that their stations, especially ones with smaller audiences, might somehow get left out of an arrangement should a company like Google come in and say, we're only going to show these channels to our customers.
Mm-hmm. But we were in the age of cord cutters now. Isn't that the trend?
You know, it's the trend, and it continues to be, and it has been for a while, but there are still millions and millions of people who subscribe to cable through traditional means, and there are going to continue to be. And a lot of people who subscribe to streaming services like HBO Now, some of the others that have come on lately outside of sort of specific cable bundles, those people still subscribe to cable. I think the FCC's position is, look, yes, there will be something coming to replace the cable box. That's already happening. But people will still be using cable boxes for at least a decade. We may as well try to protect and give those people options while it's even around.
Let me ask our listeners what they think of the cable box. Our number, 844-724-8255, 844-SciTalk. You can also tweet us at SciFry. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI Public Radio International, talking about the FCC coming up with a proposal that they might do away with having your cable box. Maybe other people might be able to create one for you. Well, Brian Barrett is a contributing editor at Wired Magazine, talking with us about that. You would think that Roku and tech companies would be on the side of the FCC proposal, but they've remained quiet, haven't they?
That's right. Well, some tech companies are vocally in favor. Google has been vocally in favor. TiVo has been in favor. But you're right. Roku is an example of a company that has so far, they haven't exactly come out against, but they've been explicitly not for. Their position is they want to wait and see what happens. And it does make sense. You would think they would be a natural fit. They already make hardware to stream. But that's part of their concern. What Roku has said when I've talked to them is that they're worried that the FCC's guidelines will be too strict, and they'll say that a set-top box or a cable delivery system has to look a certain way, and that might obviate innovation that happens in other fields. In the same way that 10 years ago, you might not have predicted that a Roku could exist at all, they're worried that the FCC might be legislating what a cable box can be in a way that cuts off a potential for what might be a solution 10 years from now. Roku is an interesting case, too, because they already have some deals lined up. They have a deal with Time Warner Cable where you can stream Time Warner Cable through Roku. So I think from Roku's position, they're saying, look, we've already put in the work and made these deals. We don't want to open up this system to be a free-for-all when we've really made some aggressive plays already ourselves.
Mm-hmm. And there are differing arguments about how the FCC proposal would affect minority groups. Go through those with us, please.
That's right. So on the one hand, there are some proprietors of stations that are focused on minority groups that say, we have deals in place with these cable companies. We know for a fact that these cable companies are going to deliver our shows and that we are going to get the ad revenue off of those shows. Their concern is that if, say, Google is sort of the popular boogeyman in this case, if Google comes out with a cable box, maybe Google decides, you know what, it's easier if we just show our customers the 40 top channels that we know that through our data that they would like. And so they're worried about getting left out of a channel lineup or buried so deep in a channel lineup that they'll never get discovered. And they're worried that a company like Google, which has a lot of expertise in advertising, will end up selling ads against their products surreptitiously. On the other side of that, there are some, both on the programming side and on the lobbying groups that are in favor of the new FCC ruling, the argument is that more opportunity is more opportunity. So more competition leads to more boxes, leads to more chances for everybody. Mm-hmm. In the way that a hypothetical Google box would put YouTube on par with NBC, potentially, a group that has a very targeted audience has a chance to get exposure outside of the traditional cable system, which would be a net good.
Mm-hmm. And so how the FCC proposal, how soon would this take effect? Would that, it must be grandfathered in for a while, I would imagine.
It is. I think there are a few steps ahead. So right now, as you mentioned, we're in the comment period. And then after that, the FCC has to vote again. For there even to be a ruling at all, late summer would be an aggressive estimate. I imagine it would take longer than that. And then from there, it would be a couple of years until the rules actually kick in. So you're right. You're looking at a very long timeline. And throughout that timeline, as people have said, fewer and fewer people will be using cable boxes to begin with.
Gosh, a few years from now, who knows what the landscape would be like?
That's true, and I think that's a valid point. But I do think, in the same way that there are still people who don't have high-definition televisions, there are still people who haven't adopted to the latest and greatest, I think we're going to see a ton of new options, and there are going to be a lot of ways for people to cut the cord 2 years from now. I think that we forget sometimes, though, that it takes a very long time for a high percentage of Americans to come around to those new technologies.
Yeah, that's true. Brian, thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Thanks so much.
You're welcome. Brian Barrett is a contributing editor for Wired, based out of Birmingham, Alabama, and he joined us from WBHM studios. Oh, finally, I want to thank all of you who bought tickets for Ched Talks. That's our wine and cheese night at Murray's Cheese here in New York. And I'm sorry to say it's sold out. Yeah, I know, all of you cheese lovers. But if you want to learn about upcoming sci-fi happenings, we have a lot more coming up. Head over to sciencefriday.com/events. And again, another event, Science Trivia Geeks in New York City area. And you know who you are. We're hosting our second annual Trivia Night. Yes, it's been asked for. It's going to be back at the Bell House in Brooklyn on Wednesday, May 18th. There are going to be drinks and prizes. And I'll be there. You can come anyhow. And I hope to see all of you. So reserve a spot for your team competition at the Bell House. I'm going to say, here it is, Bell House in Brooklyn, Wednesday, May 18th. Be there, and we'll have a great contest. We're going to have a lot of fun, even live music. BJ Lederman composed this theme music, and our thanks to our production partners at the studios of the City University of New York. I'm Ira Flatow. Have a great weekend. We'll see you next week.